Lights. Hello. Good morning. Yep, we're on. It's amazing. I don't know if you've ever done an IQ test and measured your supposed intelligence, but apparently I score really high on IQ tests. Don't confuse that with having intelligence, because as high as an IQ as I have, it only tells you that I'm good at doing IQ tests and remembering to switch on little things like this box in my rear pocket. And figuring out how to wire these things around your ear, it gets very confusing. Don't mistake an IQ for intelligence. There's a big difference. And don't mistake it for wisdom either, because you can have all the knowledge in the world, but wisdom, if you don't know how to apply that knowledge, if you don't know how to use that, you're in trouble. Hence, I get into trouble an awful lot. Okay, so this morning, I've been charged with the task of running through chapter 5 of Nehemiah. And I got pretty excited when the list came around and said, hey, it's open, who wants to speak, grab a portion of the text. Because I glanced through and reading the different chapters, and I saw chapter 5, and instantly I gravitate toward this theme that is evident, which we're going to unpick in just a few minutes. And it's very personal to me, so I got very excited. But like most times, when you pick out the word and you start getting into it and you start unpicking what each verse means and you get the whole story in a context, you realize there's so much more depth. In the interest of safety and your good health, I'm going to try and keep this fairly brief today, because I could go on for weeks on this. I'm so fueled by reading this passage, but I'm going to try and keep it to the point. I'm taking stock, it is nearly 7 minutes to the hour. Let's see how close we can get to about a 20-minute spot. Let me begin by reading this out. Then there arose a great outcry from the common people and their wives against their brothers, the wealthier Judeans. Some of them said, counting our sons and daughters, there are a lot of us. Allow us to get grain for them so that we can eat and stay alive. There were also some who said, we are mortgaging our fields, vineyards, and homes in order to buy grain because of the famine. Yet others said, we have borrowed money for the king's taxes against our field and vineyards. Now our flesh is no different from the flesh of our kinsmen, and our children are the same as their children. Yet we are bringing our sons and daughters into bondage as slaves. Some of our daughters have gone into slavery already, and it's beyond our power to do anything about it because other men have our fields and vineyards. When I heard that outcry and the reasons for it, I became very angry. I thought the matter over and then took issue with the nobles and rulers. I charged them, you are lending against pledges, everyone to his brother. And I summoned a great assembly to deal with them. I said to them, we to the limit of our ability have redeemed our brothers, the Judeans, who sold themselves to the pagans. Now you are selling your own brothers, and we will have to buy them back. They stayed silent. They couldn't think of anything to say. I also said, what you are doing is not good. You should be living in fear of our God so that our pagan enemies won't have grounds for deriding us. Moreover, my brothers and my servants, I too have loaned them money and grain. Please, let's stop making it so burdensome to go into debt. Please, today, give them back their fields, their vineyards, olive groves, and homes. Also, the 100 pieces of silver and the grain, the wine and the olive oil, as you demand from them as interest. They answered, we will give it back. We will require nothing from them. Yes, we will do it just as you say. Then I called the Kohanim, the priest, and took an oath from them that they would do as they had promised. Shaking out the fold in my garment, I said, may God thus shake every man from his house and from his work who fails to live up to this promise. May he be shaken out like this and made empty. The whole assembly said, amen, and praised Adonai, and the people did as they had promised. And besides that, from the time I was appointed their governor in the land of Yehuda, from the 20th year until the 32nd year of Artaxerxes the reign, that is 12 years, neither I nor my colleagues drew on the governor's living allowance. The earlier governors before me had burdened the people, taxing them more than 1.5 pounds of silver shekels for food and wine, and even their servants lorded it over the people, but I didn't, because I feared God. Moreover, I put all my energy into working on this wall. We didn't buy any land, and all my servants were gathered there for the work. There were 150 leaders and other Judeans who ate at my temple, besides those who came to us from the surrounding nations. Every day, one ox, six choice sheep, and fowl were prepared for me, and every 10 days a supply of all kinds of wine. Yet in spite of all this, I never claimed the governor's allowance, because the people were already bearing the heavy burden of their labor. My God, remember favorably everything I have done for this people." So that's Nehemiah recounting. Well, if you think about last week, we heard from Nick about the enemy outside of the borders, putting a lot of pressure on the Judeans, intimidating, threatening, and actually coming with threats of violence. And it looked pretty hairy. It looked, you know, this is going to be a challenge. But they weren't just fighting the enemy without, they were fighting the enemy within. And this passage is really dealing with the heart of the Judeans. This is a call to action. This is a challenge. And this reeks of way back in 1 Samuel when Saul was challenged, and that heart of what's better, sacrifice, keeping the ritual, or doing the right thing, which is to obey the Lord. This reeks of God's compassion and mercy being a standard for us to live by, rather than trying to have our own wisdom on things. Let's pick this thing apart. So the very first verse says there's a great outcry, not a complaint, not a, "Hey guys, I've got a problem here." This is a great outcry. Something is desperately wrong. There are people who are very, very upset here. And the people that are upset are the common people and their wives. Interesting that it adds "and their wives." In the male, patriarchal, male-dominated society, the wives had a voice here. The common people and their wives. So this is, do you know what? Breaking a little of the social boundary about who's allowed to even make a comment here. People are rising up and making a great outcry. And this is what the outcry is. They're making it against the wealthier Judeans. This isn't a cry against the different peoples around the borders. This isn't against the people who've got them in exile, who are holding them as a subsidized nation. This is our own people. This is the common people saying, our own brothers, the wealthier ones, mind, we have a problem with them. And then they say, counting our sons and daughters, there's a lot of us. Okay, what's that supposed to mean? Our sons and daughters, there's a lot of us, okay? Allow us to get growing for them. What they're saying is, we have a very large family. We all have families, and we are struggling to feed them. Let us get grain. Okay, so we have hungry people. We have people very upset. And they say, we need grain so that we can stay alive. So clearly, there's a bit of a famine going on. There's people here who are really, really struggling and struggling to put food on the tables. And there's a couple of reasons for this. One is that they're all pretty busy doing the work of rebuilding the walls. A lot of the Jews at this point had stopped their regular farming to help rebuild. And they've done this in trust that somehow this is going to work out. You know, it's like when you take that step of letting go of a piece of work so you can do another one, hoping that the finance is there. Well, it wasn't. The grain wasn't there. The produce of the land wasn't there. They were struggling to feed their families. But that wasn't the only issue. So the common people are upset about the fact they can't even put food on the tables. And there's a bit of an economy crisis going on. Because at this point in history, the Persian Empire had shifted their stock. Currency as we know it had kind of gone out of fashion. And they'd melted down all the gold and put it into storage. And so actual currency in your hands, things that could be exchanged, it was hard to come by. And that actually causes trouble for the poor. Getting your hands on actual cash to be able to trade, to be able to buy food is difficult. So there's this circumstance around which makes it very difficult for people to put food on their table. Not only that, but we have another issue. There were also some other people who said, we're mortgaging our fields, our vineyards, and our homes in order to buy grain because of the famine. So there's these people at the very bottom who've got nothing. There's other people who have something but have had to kind of sell it on and no longer have ownership. The bank has the title. I don't really own this anymore. people are struggling. This is an economic depression. Not an easy time at all. And yet others said, we have borrowed money for the king's taxes against our fields and vineyards. So there's people also struggling because the Persians levied huge taxes on the people who did have ownership. So there's an economic depression and everybody is hurting. At the lowest end, economically, you've got people with nothing who are just bound and struggling to put food on the table. There are people who have stuff and have to sell it off. And there are people who have stuff and can afford to not sell it off, but are still kind of under pressure with this crazy level of tax. So this is not an easy time. This is a lot of stress. You know, when our economy changes, we all feel a little nervous, even if we're doing okay. When we're not doing okay, that becomes a huge weight, a huge burden on these people. Then that verse 5, says, now our flesh is no different from the flesh of our kinsmen, and our children are no different from their children. And this is an important line because this captures a modern-day theme too. In fact, let me come back to that in just a second. Yet we are bringing our sons and daughters into bondage as slaves. Some of our daughters have gone into slavery already, and it's beyond our power to do anything about it because all our wealth is already measured out to pay our debts. And this is the bit that got me. This is when I saw this passage, I wanted to just tear into this. And it, like most times that you grab a piece of scripture and want to teach or preach on it, it does more probably for you than it ever would do me speaking to you guys about it. But some of you probably know, I've probably spouted this information before, but before I came to the USA, Aaron and I were married 12 years in England. And for the last 7 years of my time there, I worked as a non-profit guy. I signed up to work for this local charity called Street Teams, who had a track record in dealing with the sex industry, in rescuing girls from modern-day slavery. I was brought on to work with male victims, and I spent 7 years. I worked with 123 young males who'd all been modern-day slaves, taken advantage of by people who knew how to use their intelligence, their affluence, their abilities, their charm to manipulate and control others and treat them as slaves. It's a little different from the slavery we're looking at here, but at the heart, it's the same issue, right? I worked with 123 young men. I also worked on some of the cases with the females, obviously not one-to-one because we have female workers for female victims, but I got to be involved in some of the cases there. So all in all, I probably worked over 150 cases in 7 years. And the common theme, not exclusively, but almost probably 145 out of those 150 people, young children, this is just under 18s, this is not, we worked with adults besides, we didn't even count. 150, about 145 of those, I could probably think of three or four, maybe five cases that weren't economically disadvantaged. Every one of them grown up in some kind of poverty. Money's a big pull. If you have no money and your family is struggling and you're a young kid and you have nowhere to go and you're looked down upon by other people and then someone comes along with money and buys you gifts and treats you and takes advantage of you because suddenly they can use that influence. The control in these kids' lives, it's hard to not think like a slave anymore, let me tell you, when you rescue them from what they've been involved in. But out of those few that maybe weren't economically disadvantaged, they were poor in other ways. Because the other common theme, which would have been current with every single one of those cases, was an emotional lack, where they'd not been cared for, and they were lacking, they were desperate for emotional investment. So that not having, that sense of not having, here we're talking about physical, you know, not having cash, not having possessions. But being deprived of any kind of wealth makes you vulnerable. And these people were feeling vulnerable right now. And people, other Judeans, other people of the same race, the same type, were taking advantage of their own people. Go back to that flesh being no different. Our flesh is no different from their flesh. Our children are the same. Why are they taking advantage of us? We're the same people. Maybe this is echoed somewhat in our modern-day struggle with race. Don't we bleed the same blood, regardless of color? Our flesh is their flesh, right? Well, this is a bit of a needle now. To get from here, to get from this place of seeing people as the same, people have taken advantage, and they've done it by justifying their difference. I, as a rich man, can say, do you know what? It's okay, because me taking advantage of this person over here and making him a slave, I'm actually providing him work, maybe. You know, the Jewish system was you'd come on as a hired worker for 7 years. Maybe I'm taking something off them, but they, you know, if you've mortgaged your field, then at least I've given you the money to pay your taxes. You know, you can justify things any way you want. But the thing is, in your mind, the rich guy, in his mind, has separated these people with a different economic class. Don't we have a history of doing that as mankind? You know, the USA probably thinks a lot about its racial tensions, but you know what? I think England was there a little way before you guys. We were slaveholders way, way back. I've shared this with many of you before as well, and I have, as a child, I was given a gift of two slave rings, two copper, bronze, alloy, metal rings that were just pieces of metal, three-quarter circle, and a guy would hold them on a stick, and the white British shipmaster who's traveled to the west coast of Africa would go up to the tribal leader, and he would slide this currency onto another stick. We wouldn't touch skin, wouldn't shake hands, not touching each other, because, you know, the shipmaster who's white doesn't want to touch a black man. But he'll buy his wares, he'll buy his produce, and the produce, the thing he was selling, was either his own people, but more often other tribes. This currency, these pieces of metal that are actually pretty worthless, they now sell for about £150, $225, because they're an antique, rich, you know, an antique item. But they're just pieces of metal. People's lives were traded for just junk that we call currency. And somehow, as a child, I was given two of these by a guy who'd been deep sea diving, found them off an old sunken slave ship off the south coast of England. I had no idea at the time what that might mean years down the line, but I was bowled over just thinking about it this morning. Again, every time I think about this, you know, sometimes God just plans something for your life that you have no control over. I had no idea that I was going to be involved in setting slaves free. And it's a beautiful thing, because it's not just modern-day slaves in the sex industry. It's not just economically deprived. I get to pray for the sick. I get to minister to the brokenhearted. I get to set slaves free. But God plants seeds in us that last a lifetime. And I'm privileged this morning to be looking at this and thinking, wow, something of this passage, God had already invested in me before I'd even read the passage. You know, this is, life just sometimes doesn't make a whole lot of sense, but then you see the threads work together. It's back to the text. So people are sold into slavery. Some of the daughters have already gone into slavery, and you know what that means. Maybe some of it is cleaning the house, but we're talking sex industry again. But Nehemiah, and I didn't think I'd identify very much with Nehemiah at first because he was actually a fairly wealthy guy, which we'll come on to in a few minutes. But Nehemiah, I really identify with this. This guy is sharp. This guy is intelligent. You have got a huge socioeconomic issue. You have got culture up in arms. You have got people struggling to put food on the table. Whilst they're also slaves to the Persian Empire, things are not good. And nothing's being done about it. And Nehemiah steps into the fray. He's got a vision, by the way. We're not forgetting the wall. We're not forgetting rebuilding and the mission that God has charged him with. But he recognizes this. He's sharp enough to see that this is going to be a major problem. Because we can protect ourselves. We can build up our walls and protect ourselves against the different empires. But if we don't guard our hearts, it is all in vain. If we do not change the way we are living, the walls will crumble internally. You can look good on the outside. The walls of Jerusalem will look pretty. They'll look solid. People will say, wow, what an amazing city, but we'll be worthless. We'll be dead inside. We have got to do something about this. So Nehemiah he's up with some fury, with some energy about this. You know, when he hears their outcry and the reasons for it, he says, I became very angry. And this anger is like the righteousness of God looking at sin and saying, this cannot be. We cannot allow this to happen. This is what's welling up in Nehemiah. He's like, come on, we've got to get rid of this thing. We've got to do something about it. When you feel that in that verse 6, I'm like, yeah, I can buy into that. I feel this charge. I want to go back in time and do something about it right now. It's already been done. He did it. But I want to connect to the story somehow. Then he says, I thought the matter over and then took issue with the nobles and rulers. This guy is sharp. He doesn't just go out. I get passionate about these things. I want to charge in and say, come on, stop. But he's like, we got to think about this. If I tackle this the wrong way, we miss it. We got to put an end to this slavery. We got to put an end to this death. But I can't be unwise. I have to use what I know to be wise enough to make a difference. And he charges them. So he's thought about what he's going to say. This is not just a random bunch of comments. This is not like I would, charging in and saying, guys, come on, stop, this is ridiculous. You know, he is thinking carefully, and he's gone back, and he's used a legal precedent. He's used history. He's used the law given by God. He says, I charge them, you are lending against pledges everyone to his brother, which back in Exodus 20-something is specifically mentioned as crime. We do not do this. This is an abomination to the Lord. Let alone, you know, slavery might have been a practice, but putting your own people in slavery wasn't acceptable. Lending against pledges, putting your own people into debt, not acceptable. It says you're doing everyone to his brother. You're treating your own people. You're treating people who deserve respect, people who deserve life and freedom, and your compassion, you're treating them like your dogs. You're treating them like a commodity. You're treating people like stuff. So he summons a great assembly, which they've not really that long into the big work of building up the wall. So calling a great assembly at this time is kind of a big deal. This sort of thing you might do at the end of building the wall, but here in the midst of this 50-plus day of building the walls, he says, okay, everyone get together. And he's got a bit of power and influence, so he's able to do it, but he gets everyone into one spot and says, we have to address this. Everyone probably knew that this was coming because we can justify our sin, we can justify what we choose to do, but we kind of know, don't we? When sin grabs a hold of us, we know it's wrong, but we just do it anyway. So when these guys get called to the Great Assembly, some of them probably had an inkling, we've been charged, we know what's coming. We're in trouble. But still he's wise. He says to them, to the limit of our ability, we have redeemed our brothers. the Judeans who sold themselves to the pagans. Nehemiah is saying, I'm actually in the habit of using what wealth I have, and his position as the cupbearer was actually quite wealthy. He had lots of opportunity to do more, but you know, he did okay. He had enough to go buy slaves and buy their freedom. He would go around, and whenever he saw the opportunity, as far as he could, he would pay for someone to be released. He would pay off the debt so that they could be free. Which in itself is an incredible type. Looking to Jesus, paying our own debts for us. It says, I'm in the habit of rescuing slaves. I'm in the habit of paying for the freedom. You guys are doing the exact opposite. I am charged by God to release captives, and you are putting people into captivity. What is going on? We know compassion. You're doing control. I'm doing freedom. You're doing making slaves. What is that about? Now we have to buy these guys back. We have to pay for them all over again. And some of the practice here is those Judeans who had wealth knew of Nehemiah's practices. They kind of did it knowing that, you know what? Nehemiah will sort it out. He'll use some of that wealth he can find. He'll pay for their freedom. Like, that's a good reason to put someone into slavery? That's like me coming to your house and saying, do you know what? I just bought a new house and I don't have an oven for it that works. I'm going to turn up at the Favels house, and when they're not looking, I'm going to just walk out with this huge oven, you know, because that'd happen, right? Now, I know you could probably replace the oven, but is anyone in their right mind going to think that's an acceptable practice? Not least because you'd be stupid trying to walk out with an oven, but especially me, I can barely lift this Bible. It's just stupid when you think about it. This is not a good use of our intellect. This is not a good use of what God has given us. Think about what you're doing. Just because we can do something about it, do I sell someone into slavery, even for a short period? Because let me tell you, the other thing is one thing taking something that belongs to someone else, but when you put someone into slavery, whether it's the sex industry, whether it's immense debt, it does damage. Working with some of the kids that I'd worked with, some of them couldn't even see that they were being abused. Because when you're sold into slavery, as one of these daughters would have been, and you're still forming your concept of how the world works, you're still young. You don't fully understand the world, and some of your earliest experiences are being utterly and completely controlled. You can be freed from that, but you're still going to think like a slave. You will think that certain practices are okay. You will think that certain behaviors by your controlling person are acceptable. And it takes time to change that. To give you a clue, just being able to talk with the young guy who's been abused sexually, let alone all the myriad controlling issues through that modern-day slavery, just the abuse alone takes about a year of solid, consistent, integrity-filled contact where you do what you say so they can learn to trust you. About a year just to start the real conversation. Because it's embarrassing, or we don't understand it, or I can only think of the things that some of my young guys had said. Some of them didn't even recognize, you know, things would have happened to them, disgusting things, violent things. And they'd be like, well, that's just what happens, isn't it? That's just how we live. That's just the way the world works. No, that's not how the world works. That's how abusers work. That's how controlling people work. But I've got to set this guy free. How do I can buy him out of slavery. I can rescue him from the abuser. There's a much bigger work up here. So you can sell someone into slavery for a short period of time. Sure, Nehemiah will rescue them. He'll pay for them. It's good. Only the lifetime of damage that's done in the process, let alone the fact that you feel betrayed by your own people. Because someday, even if you're young, you'd be conscious of the fact that your own people betray you, and that's not good. That's not healthy. Your self-esteem, your self-worth. So Nehemiah has really cut to the heart here. And their reaction, the people's reaction, they had nothing to say. The word says they couldn't think of anything to say. They were so convicted. They knew, full stop, that they had sinned. They had controlled and hurt and damaged. And there was no excuse. They couldn't justify this. Exodus. The word of the Lord had said, you do not do this. It's been presented to you. Where have you got to go? Faced with the truth? Where do you go? Nehemiah carries on. What you're doing is not good. There's no way we can ever justify. You should be living in fear of our God. And if you live in fear of God, you live with compassion toward people. If you live with the fear of God and you hold him in reverence, if you understand what a holy and awesome God he is, you know that when he commanded that you should love him with all your heart, mind, soul, and strength, and love your neighbor as yourself, that's not optional. The great command didn't say, love God and then love people. The scripture says, the second command is like the first. It's equal to. It's an equal footing. These are two pillars on which you stand. And if you treat one as lower than the other, okay, I'm standing on loving the Lord you got up here, but I'm people loving people. It's kind of, you know, it's not very comfortable standing like this. Now, the point is you're imbalanced. To love God is to love people. And to love people is to love God. And if you cannot show compassion toward people, notwithstanding the fact we all had to grow and mature, and we're going to get it wrong, but if you cannot show compassion to people, if you can justify the sin, you're not loving God. I know we all here want to love God, and so anytime we find our attitude toward another human being out of sync, whether it's the psychotic driver who cuts you up at the corners, I do not understand driving in this country, I really don't, but people cutting you up on the corners, whether it's your siblings and you're falling out with people over shared toys, or whether it's your partner, your husband or wife, and you've had a blowout about some crazy issue, whether it's a theological difference within the church, the command is to love. The command is to love the Lord your God with all your heart, mind, and soul, and strength, and that means you put that relationship right. You demonstrate compassion to that person, because it's not about you. Our desire is to honor him, we sang this morning. It's not about us. So here we are. Hopefully these people are getting the message, right? That we have got to stop these practices. We have got to start showing compassion to our own people. You could almost understand it if they were being showing this kind of control and evil and selling people into slavery to some other people. Because you could justify that a little easier, but they're doing it to their own people. Give them back. Give everything back to them that you owe. Set them free. Let them go. Let's deal with this. And what I love about this is Nehemiah's attitude in it starts with a lot of humility. It sounds like he's coming and ranting. It sounds like he's coming and saying, you guys have got this completely wrong. And right here, in verse 10, he says, brothers and my servants, I too have loaned them money and grain. Please, let's stop making it so burdensome to go into debt. Nehemiah is complicit. He's not coming with a holier-than-thou attitude. He's not coming like, guys, you have messed up. I'm telling you, you've got it right. It's like, we have got to change. We have to do something about this. You know, there was a great article on the race relation issue because of all the stuff that's been going on, and talking about the fact that white people don't like to talk about our inherent racism. I worked for I worked in the youth services, local government, for a short period, 2004-2005, and my manager was Jamaican. Jamaican descent, British born, worked in the armed forces, had been an officer in Northern Ireland, and then ended up in the youth service. And when I spoke to him, one day he started to tell me about my racism. And of course, I did exactly what this article was talking about. I suddenly got very defensive. I'm not racist. I love people. I like people. I've got black friends. I've got Indian friends. I've got Asian friends. I'm not racist. He wasn't making the point that I have this burning desire to judge another person or to be mean toward another person. He's saying I'm complicit in a system that is geared towards favoring one person rather than another. And if I don't do something with that position of power that I have, I'm complicit. I'm a part of the problem. Unless I speak up and say, guys, we can't live this way, myself included, I'm part of the problem. If I see a young guy or gal being sold into slavery and say nothing, I'm part of the problem. If I see someone hurting and don't go to comfort them, I'm part of the problem. If I don't see someone who's sick and make sure they've been prayed for, I'm part of the problem. So the problem here is not just our attitude and our heart. It's about action. It's about, am I prepared to do something? With the race issue, it's difficult. It's complex. It's been going on for hundreds of years. Now, I know in my heart, I don't have a specific issue with somebody who's black or Asian or any other race. In fact, I often feel like being an Irish kid brought up in a place where the Irish were the poor guys and the regular English were pretty vociferous. They were pretty mean to us at times. I felt like I'd been the victim of racism, which I had. But still, I have, as a white, middle-aged, middle-class guy, I have all this power and influence in a system that judges against others. And if I do nothing about it, I've seen people not get jobs because of the color of their skin. I've seen things happen where people have been taken advantage of because of the color of their skin. If I don't do something about that when I have the chance, to the limit of my ability, I'm part of the problem. So, man, I've gone way over what I expected to do. I'm going to wrap this up. The point here is action. It goes on to talk about the economic issues. Nehemiah had a whole bunch of opportunity to tax people too. He had, he could have charged, I think, something in the region of $2,500 as a, you know, comparatively, as another tax. This, the, however many, half pound and a half of silver shekels for food and wine, part of the social custom, and his job would have been to entertain large groups of people. And he could have levied a tax on top of all the other taxes. And on top of it, imagine if you had a $2,500 tax bill for someone wanting to eat and drink with and party, land on you, you'd be pretty upset, right? Nehemiah had the opportunity. It would have been right for him to do that in the culture that he was in. It would have been okay for him to do that in his job. But the rest of this passage really is he's saying, do you know what? I've not got it all right. I'm complicit in the problem here, but let me tell you, I have been working on these things. I have been working on my attitude, and I've not taken advantage of people when I could have done. My heart is this side of the coin. My heart is this side of the issue. I want to get this thing right. I want to see people looked after. I've not burdened people unnecessarily whilst recognizing that I'm also part of a larger problem. The people answered to him and said, okay, we'll give it back. We agree. He says, that's great. Now we'll call in the priest and we're going to get this done officially because, you know what, I can call you to action and you can sign up, getting volunteers to come work for your nonprofit or getting donations in. You know, I've been a nonprofit guy for many years. You always get lots of well-meaning people saying, yes, we will, we'll contribute, we'll come and give you time. And the reality is that, you know, people get busy, life carries on. We can't always do. But call to action without some kind of landing point means it's just going to go by the wayside. Getting people to stop and agree is great. Getting people to stop, agree, and then do something about it and stick to their word. Nehemiah trying to get these hundreds and thousands to change a socioeconomic system that's keeping them in pocket, you know. That's not an easy thing. But they swear in front of a priest. They make an offering. They have a right. They have an official landing. And then he says he takes the oath that they would do as they promised. So now they're not just able to justify what they do anymore. They know they're answerable to God. They've taken it away from being justified, taken away their own opportunity to defend themselves. And then he says, shaking out the fold of my garment, a prophetic symbol, just to tie it all off. Any man who doesn't follow suit now, anyone who's agreed to do this today, to start setting our slaves free, to rescue our daughters from the sex industry, the abuse industry, to pay off the debt of our people who are economically burdened. If you don't do that, may God shake you like I just shook the dust out of my robe, the folds out of my garment. May God leave you empty. Prophetic precedent, pretty scary. I, for one, do not want to be one of those guys who gets shaken out like a fold in the garment and disappears. He finishes up by saying, he talks about the fact that he didn't take advantage of people. What I really like about the end of all of this, he says, you know what, I could have charged all kinds of taxes. I could have done so much, but I didn't. And he finishes by saying, my God, remember favorably everything I've done for this people. God, remember what I've done. And you know what? He's not saying this is a pride. This is not a pride thing. This is not Nehemiah saying, look at the fantastic things I've done. He's like, God, look at me kindly when you see what I've done. I hope it's been good enough. I hope this has honored you. He's not the proud guy saying, I've changed the world. Social justice seems like a modern buzzword. It was happening back here in Nehemiah. And it wasn't, look at the fantastic things we do. It was, I hope this is enough, because the work doesn't end. Okay, a little emotional at times there. And if I could land a point, if I could leave you with anything to take away today, it would be that inaction is an action. Not doing something when you know you should, when you know it's right, is a powerful action. I'm going to leave it there. Thank you.